This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome Rick Doblin. He's founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, also known as MAPS. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, Charlotte, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And in the context of this symposium where there's people who have been studying psychedelics in their many myriad manifestations, how did you come to this work yourself? You've been doing it since you were a college student.
Yeah, I was 18 years old in 1972 when I decided to devote myself to becoming a psychedelic therapist, to going through psychedelic therapy, and then trying to bring psychedelics back to the culture in a legal way.
You knew that when you were 18?
Yeah, I did. And it's great now I'm 62 and actually looking back to think that what I'm doing now is based on an idea that I still think is a good idea that I had when I was 18. And it's been kind of a through line throughout my entire life. And what led me to that was several different factors. So I was born in 1953, and I have a lot of Israeli relatives and a lot of relatives, distant relatives that were killed in the Holocaust. And so I was raised with an understanding about, you know, the miraculous creation of the State of Israel and the horrors of the Holocaust. And I grew up in a small town outside of Chicago called Skokie, and it was like an entirely Jewish community. I thought the whole world was Jewish. And the idea that cultural insanity and scapegoating was a threat. So I grew up with this background level of fear, but sort of in the foreground, I've realized now in retrospect, I had three tremendous aspects that gave me a lot of confidence. One was just being in America after World War II and being in the strongest country in the world and sort of growing up with this milieu of American exceptionalism, which I've now, you know, come to outgrow and see was, you know, false thinking, but still. So I grew up this strength of America and also this idea of being the Jewish chosen people. And then I was the firstborn male child.
Oh my goodness.
So I got all of this kind of like, and my parents were assimilated. My grandparents had been on one side immigrants and my great-grandparents on the other, and they had done well. So I had this sense of security, and that helped me to realize as I was growing up that the kind of issues that I needed to address were not so much about where is food and shelter going to come from, but about deeper levels of security and safety. So I pondered a lot about the scapegoating and the dehumanization and the murderous aspects of human nature. And then I was a young 10-year-old, you know, around that time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was something that really scared me because we were in school and we were taught about how, you know, duck and cover under your school desk, and that this could protect you from nuclear explosion. And the whole idea that the world could really erupt in this nuclear conflagration, and that that was a real threat. And that, again, that that would be a psychological manifestation of sort of insanity, you know, for people to launch all these incredible weapons and poison the environment and kill perhaps everybody. It just was a terrifying thing. And then seeing the whole civil rights struggle and the cities and the riots, and then also being in the last year of the lottery for Vietnam and actually being having to address whether I was going to be asked to go be in the military and go off and kill people or be killed for what seemed increasingly to be a, you know, mindless, senseless mistake of a war. In 1968, I actually was in Chicago, and I volunteered for Gene McCarthy as a precinct captain. But at that,
Candidate for president in 1968, Democrat.
yeah, the peace candidate. Now, I was only at that time almost 15. And so I was in a fairly conservative area. My parents, of course, were liberal Democrats, but McCarthy didn't win in this area. And I became the precinct captain because nobody else wanted to do it, nobody older that could even vote. So then when he didn't win, I volunteered for Mayor Daley, and I worked inside the Chicago Convention as a runner for the delegates. And so I was sort of in the convention when the riots were going on in downtown Chicago.
Oh my goodness.
So all of this kind of educated me about the fact that there was a lot of problems that were threatening my survival as an individual, as a group, Jewish, as part of the human race, and that these were problems were fundamentally psychological, and that, and at the same time we're having the moonshot, and so people are having this incredible confidence in technology, and so it felt like we could solve these problems if we had the proper emotional and spiritual maturity. So I didn't know what to do with that because I also believed that the LSD, if you took it, it made you crazy and that it could permanently damage your brain even from one time. My parents are not drinkers, they weren't smokers. So I grew up very interested in psychology, but very negatively influenced by the propaganda about how harmful the psychedelics were. So I didn't really try them in high school, and it was my first year in college where I just read a book by an author that I thought was a fantastic book, and I was studying the other. I was studying Russian in high school, and my parents actually sent me to Russia when I was 16, and that's where I started realizing these are real people here. These are not, they don't all hate me. They don't all want to kill me. These are it's political systems, but it's not like humans hating necessarily other humans. And so somebody in my Russian class gave me a book, and I loved it. And then he told me that part of it had been written under the influence of LSD. And I was like, that's impossible. LSD can't produce something like this. It was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by Ken Kesey.
Oh.
And that's what made me decide to try LSD. So once I tried LSD, I didn't have these immediate mystical experiences. I was very much scared of letting go, not very open to my emotions. But it helped me feel, whereas before I hadn't really felt anything. And I got these intimations and glimmers that there was a deeper connectivity and a deeper aspects to our consciousness, and how much of our behavior is motivated by unconscious factors, and that we can make them conscious. And that was again 1971 and 72, and I was so determined to try to move forward. And that was also after the backlash against the hippies and the psychedelics had taken place, and psychedelic research was pretty much banned all over the world. And Nixon was ascendant, and the war on Viet in Vietnam was still going. And so I ended up having trouble with these LSD experiences, and I went to the guidance counselor at college, and it was a experimental college, New College of Florida. It was a private school. It was designed to facilitate students' curiosity. So it was people from all over the world, all over the country were there, and it had no grades. It was a fantastic school. And the guidance counselor was fairly sympathetic.
I mean, you went to the guidance counselor and said, I'm having trouble interpreting my LSD experiences.
Exactly. Yeah. And because it was a private school too, and we felt like the police were protecting us from the campus police were protecting us from the real police. We had this tradition of all-night dances under the stars with psychedelics in the Palm Court. The school was designed by I.M. Pei. It was, fantastic architecture, and the nudist colony at the swimming pool was astonishing. And it felt like this was this oasis of sanity, and it really was like the Herod experiment. This like nudist colony for college students. It was, you can imagine how delightful it was, and I went to the guidance counselor and I said, I'm having these problems. And it's there was a woman who had actually studied with Jung, Marian Hoppen, and she was a professor, and her family had donated the swimming pool. And I was in her class, but I felt like this is so still ordered and patterned and calm. I just was a rage of emotions. I couldn't even get into this class on Jung. And the guidance counselor said, well, there's a book that you might want to read. And it was a manuscript copy of Realms of the Human Unconscious by Stan Grof before it even come out. And somehow this guidance counselor had it. And when I read that book, that's where it all came together for me.
Now, tell us who Stanislav Grof was.
Well, he's still.
Is.
Yeah. So he's about 85 right now. Stan Grof is the world's leading LSD researcher. He was from the Czech Republic, from Czechoslovakia. And in the 50s, he did LSD research, starting in the 50s and then into the 60s.
When it was legal.
When it was legal. And when the Russians moved in to squash the Czech Revolution, he emigrated to the United States. And he worked at Johns Hopkins with Walter Pankey, who was one of the leading psychedelic researchers at the time. And they did incredible work with LSD with alcoholics, heroin addicts, LSD with cancer patients. And Stan has been thought of as in the lines of Freud and Jung and Grof in terms of his mapping of the unconscious and based on observations from thousands of LSD trips that he observed as a therapist, psychiatrist, supporting people through their trips. Patients of all different kinds, healthy normals, religious professionals, all different kinds of people. So Stan Grof was really the most, I would say, the leading intellectual in terms of developing this framework of consciousness and psychotherapy. And so when I read his book, I felt like religion is not really to be trusted because there's so much dogma in it, but that there's something they're talking about that's not just materialism, which is good, that what Stan was doing was merging science and consciousness and spirituality and values from what he learned. And yet, it was all encased in a psychotherapeutic process. So it was utilitarian. It was actually reality checking. Are people really getting better? So a lot of times people are off into different philosophies and describing multiple universes, and you know, and I just can get lost in all that. What's the whole point of it? And you know, is there an action step? And so the fundamental action step from Stan was compassion and healing, but it engaged these larger areas of science and psychedelics and consciousness change and spirituality and religion and values. So I felt like this is really the holy grail almost. This is what I want to do. And once I realized that, I actually wrote a letter to Stan. And in 1972, I got a letter back from him. And I ended up taking a workshop with him, with Joan Halifax, after they had just been married for like a week. It was like a week after their wedding. And it was out in the Man Ranch. And so I was inspired very much by Stan, but I felt that there was no real opportunities for me, that here it was, the research had been squashed. There was no way to move forward. And I was a draft resistor for Vietnam. So I was anticipating going to jail. And that made me, and I'd studied Tolstoy and Martin Luther King and others. And so I felt like I was going to have this criminal record, and therefore I couldn't be a doctor or a lawyer or anything. I thought, well, what am I going to do with my life? And I thought, okay, I'm going to be an underground psychedelic therapist.
Now, the research had been squashed because those substances had gone from being legal to illegal, and the research basically just stopped, pretty much dried up, or the university-based research.
Yeah. The reason that the research was stopped, and the reason that right now one of the big struggles that MAPS is doing is trying to end the federal monopoly on the supply of marijuana that's legal for research, why we don't have marijuana as a federally approved FDA medicine, is that the criminalization is based on this exaggerated risk estimates and the demonization of these drugs and the drug users. And the research into medical benefits complicates the story. And the story is these drugs are so bad that one dose brain damage, you should never take them. And if you do take them, we need to protect you against yourself by putting you in jail, and we need to hunt down all the dealers. And that, So the drug war is based on the generation of fear out of proportion to the actual dangers. Not to say that there are no dangers, and people can die and people can go crazy, and there are dangers, but the drug war is based on this black and white. These are such fearful things that then people would justify mass incarceration and locking millions of people up in jail. So the research threatened all of that. And that's why the research was shut down. People didn't want to have a nuanced discussion about in clinical use, this can be beneficial, but if you take it in recreational use and you're not prepared, it can be harmful. So it's taken us now more about 45 years to bring back psychedelic research to the point where now we have more psychedelic research going on than at any time in the last 45 years. Massive renaissance in research all over the world. And one of the most important discoveries in the terms of neuroscience and psychiatry over the last 20, 30 years has actually been ketamine in the treatment of depression. Now, it's not ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, it's more ketamine as a tool for alleviating depression on an acute basis. And ketamine is a dissociative anesthetic, but in one-tenth the dose, it has a psychedelic component. So we're at a terrific situation now, but the sadness is that the enormous amount of suffering that was unnecessary, that now we see psilocybin and MDMA and LSD and ketamine can help people address all these decades and decades and decades that was just completely suppressed.
We're talking to Rick Doblin of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. You said something a moment ago, which I find interesting, which is that I think you were talking about Stanislav Grof trying to quote unquote map the unconscious. Now, map is something that in most of our minds probably applies to a geographical area that is real. And the unconscious is something that, I mean, how can it be mapped? What is the reality of that? I mean, is it like trying to make a painting of a dream, which, as we know, is just I mean, you could get at the edges of it, but it's not possible to do.
Well, I'll say that the name MAPS was inspired by a book that Ralph Metzner, who's here at the symposium, that he wrote called Maps of Consciousness. And I knew that I needed a P in whatever letter because I wanted P for psychedelic. So I think that the idea that the unconscious is unmappable is really not accurate. And I think what we're talking about and what Stan has tried, he's talked about it as the cartography of the unconscious. And Freud really started this whole awareness in Western intellectual traditions about how there is this enormous iceberg, you could say, of consciousness being the part that's above the water and the iceberg, the unconscious under the water. So, what are the different areas of the unconscious? So, according to Stan, there's three basic areas. The first is biographical. So, stuff that happens that you don't completely integrate, that for whatever reasons challenges your worldview or your sense of self-respect or your sense of ego strength or some ways, think ideas that we kind of based on things that have happened to us that we don't really pay much attention to.
What would be an example of that?
Somebody who, at a young age, felt abandoned by their mother or something, and so feels really, alone and isolated, but doesn't want to, blame their mother because, you shouldn't be doing that. So that whole kind of early loneliness or whatever is just out of awareness. Or we have it where a lot of people with childhood sexual abuse and stuff is suppressed and they
Okay,
don't
so
really pay
those
attention.
biographical details of where somebody was hurt in one way or another and carries that around with them, even though that situation is long gone.
Or it could be a an ego wound. It doesn't need to be a physical wound. Hurt in different emotional ways or even physical ways. A lot of times physical injury, car crashes can, be so scary, and that's where, a lot of what we do now is with PTSD is carrying that. But there's this area of the unconscious related to biography. Then, according to Stan, and I've experienced some of this myself in my own LSD experiences, that there's a template that's put into place for every human being when you're born, and that there's a certain, and this is the general, and again, it loads of individual variations, but you have the good womb and you're kind of floating and you're connected with, you know, your mother. And then there's starting to be these contractions that seem like no exit, like a Kafka kind of a perspective. And then there's this starting to be the, you know, as the cervix starts to open, you start having this sort of dynamic process, but it's still life-threatening. And then you're born in sort of this new kind of union with your mother, but as an individual. So that he's talked about, these are kind of emotional templates. And depending on what your birth was like, or depending on, you know, just genetics, how you're tuned for certain things, that these are underlying kind of experiences that we all have. And it's different if you're a C-section or if all different ways.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a stretch to just take on faith that a baby in the womb experiences contractions as life-threatening. I mean, it's the most natural thing in the world.
Yeah, but they are life-threatening. I mean, and there's loads of babies that die in birth and mothers that die in birth. And if you want to look in the course of human history, the number of women that die in childbirth, it's enormous. And so now, whether you can get corroborating evidence from people that go into regressed states under psychedelics, whether that's really true,
yeah.
Or whether that's just symbolic, in a way, it doesn't really matter. If there are symbolic patterns, that's how your brain is structured. And then, according to Stan, then there's this, Otto Rank was one of the students of Freud that talked a lot about the impact of birth. Freud sort of talked about your tabula rasa. You just go back to when you're born and you're just a blank slate. But, you know, there's these incredible patterns that are put into place through the process of birth. And then the third major area is the Jungian area of archetypes and symbols and symbol systems that we tend to think about or in certain ways. So that's kind of the structure of the unconscious according to the evidence that's come from psychedelic experiences, from deep meditation experiences, from all different kind of consciousness explorers.
Now, is there a cross-cultural corroboration of this kind of map?
I think that there are in some cases. Yeah, I think you always have to be careful how much are you superimposing your own perspective on something and how much of it is emerging genuinely. And I think there is some significant questioning of how many people have these kind of patterns from birth. I think a lot of it has to do with most people that haven't had such high-dose LSD or psychedelic experiences in the kind of environments that Stan was working with, in the sense with people's eyes closed and eye shades on and listening to music and having these inner trips where they're completely beyond verbal understanding or verbal labels, like, you know, before kids are even learning language. So I think that there is a lot of cross-cultural support for archetypes, for myths, for suppressing ideas from their biography. So I would say that the one of the things that's most exciting for me actually that's going on right now is actually this research with religious professionals that's being done at Johns Hopkins and at NYU. And it's taking people from different religious traditions and giving them psychedelics. These are now people that have congregations, and they're taking psychedelics in an individual setting in a laboratory, in a comfortable room, but it's a scientific study.
Yeah.
And so the question is, are there symbols that are sort of shared from people despite their religious traditions that are common? And the classic experiment that looked at whether psychedelics can produce mystical experiences was the Good Friday experiment that was done by Walter Pankey, and Tim Leary was the faculty sponsor. Ralph Metzner was involved. Ram Dass was involved. That was 1962. And they developed a questionnaire that would evaluate whether people had a mystical experience. And they did it in such a way that it was universal. So there was not, these are Christian divinity students in church on Good Friday, But none of the questions were, did you have an image of Christ on the cross? Or right. did you see the Virgin Mary? Or it was more about the universal elements about this mystical experience. And I'm sure that you'll get loads of people from different religions saying that there is no universal mystical experience. Our way is the only right way. And it's got to be this way or that way. But it's also like, the way I look at it, it's like language. You know, it's not like English is the right language and German is the wrong language or French is the wrong language. You know, these are all different cultural efforts that have developed in different cultural places and times to help people communicate to each other about the same basic kind of things. So I think religion is like that, different languages, but there's common themes.
So what's coming out of this experiment so far where they give religious leaders or whatever?
Well, they're just starting. I mean, they don't have data analysis, but that, I think, links back into more important political issues. And so there was a Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations for about 40 years, Robert Mueller, and he was like the visionary mystic at the UN. The United Nations University for Peace is in Costa Rica. He was the first chancellor of that. He helped start it. But I think it was in 82, he wrote a book called New Genesis, Shaping a Global Spirituality. And his basic thesis was that we have the United Nations to try to mediate disputes between countries, but a lot of the disputes between countries are actually based on religious differences. And we need to have kind of a united religions, which doesn't mean one world religion, but it means people that can come together. And what we've tended to notice is that the mystics of the different religions are more in common with the mystics of other religions than with the fundamentalists of their own religion. So it does feel like those people that have this experiential connection to this deeper spirituality, they're not so attached to this symbol system or that symbol system. And that suggests that there may indeed be. And the Sufi religion and the Baha'i religion, and you know, there's different attempts to try to talk about what's common between the different religions. So that for me is really the fundamental reason I'm interested in psychedelics, is that theory.
We're talking to Rick Doblin of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Now, if all mysticism, all mystics have something in common, if all mystical experience, whether it's drug-induced or whether it's induced by fasting or whether it's induced by a random experience, I mean, there's all
grace.
Sorts of stories.
Yeah.
Grace, exactly. What is that common thread? Is it a feature of the human brain? Is it a feature of a divine being that exists out there? I mean, what is your understanding of that?
Well, I don't know about divine being out there, but you could say a divine everything in here, out there, all the same, all together. I mean, something happened, as far as we can tell, you know, 14 billion years ago or whatever with the Big Bang, and to the extent that science is now, you know, the myth-making organization, and we were all in one thing. Now, you know, things have evolved, and I think the idea of this mystical sense of understanding the world is based on the structure of the universe, the structure of consciousness, that it's the deeper you go, I think the more you can see the connections to everything. Under psychedelics, people a lot of times talk about identifying with animals or identifying with plants. Dennis McKenna has told this beautiful story, I don't know if he told it to you, about how he understood photosynthesis one time by being a plant and feeling all this kind of stuff going on with the sun. And, you know, so that people can have, I mean, where did our brain come from? I mean, we have evolved from, you know, single cell animals from nothing and plants, so that there's just this thread that's, why do people do research in rats? Because we're very similar to rats and mice, and our brains are working the same. So where it comes from, and here I guess I would make an important distinction. You know, I'm very much interested in politically motivated action based on social justice principles. And that's where I liked Stan. Stan was about all these things, but it's about healing and therapy. So for me, whether we can say where this actually comes from. And even, is there really this shared mystical experience, or do different religions have, you know, they emphasize this more than that, you know, but are they fundamentally different gods? Or, you know, it's more about, for me at least, social justice in action. And that's where I tend to focus, rather than philosophy. And
so how do you get from mystical experience to social justice in action?
Well, mystical experience is this sense of connection and unity. That's the fundamental aspect of it. I mean, there's the transcendence of time and space, the deeply felt positive mood, the sense of something holy or sacred, this transitory nature of it. But I look at us and them thinking. So when I start from a young boy and just thinking, why are the Nazis, you know, saying the Jews are the source of all evil in the world, and, you know, people are projecting their shadows out and then trying to eradicate it out there. And so what can we do to help people go beyond the us and them? Or what about the nature? I mean, people used to trash nature because, you know, garbage, you throw stuff out because it's not, it's a difference. It's, you know, once you see it's all in this one system, you have a different attitude towards trash and garbage and nature. So I think the core elements of the mystical experience lead to compassion, tolerance, altruism, and that's what we need more of. And if we look at American politics right now, a lot of it is motivations on fear of the other, fear of the immigrant, fear of the Muslim, you know, fear of the other. And so I think the mystical experience of connection and unity has profound political implications. And that's really why I think we need to integrate psychedelics into our culture, because people tend not to have mystical experiences in their traditional religions. I remember my bar mitzvah did not, you know, turn me into a man or turn me into a mystic, or it just got me a lot of presents.
Right, right.
And so where are people going to have these experiences, and how, and you can also tell people something, or they can think it or read it. But I keep reminding myself of an album cover by Rita Marley. And the album was called Who Feels It Knows It. So we have to get down deeper than the intellectual understanding into this profound experience of this connection. And that will help us overcome our projections and our prejudices.
When you say that, what it makes me think about is the fact that there is an utterly scientific, and if there even is a distinction between mysticism and science, is something we could talk about forever. But, I mean, there's an utterly scientific unity of all life, which is the reality that we are, in fact, all descended from single-celled organisms, and that our ecosystem are these incredibly complex, interdependent webs of life from which we have become alienated. And if there's any experience that helps us kind of overcome the alienation caused by sort of crazy industrial consumerism, then that's great. But it is a reality that an understanding of, which, I mean, I think about, there are stories, there was a story in a book that had a very long section about prairie dogs, and there was a quote from the native Indians who lived where there were all these prairie dogs, and they said, well, without the prairie dogs, there's no water. And it's like, yeah, right, whatever, prairie dogs, water. But in fact, the prairie dogs aerate the soil, and they make all these other species possible. And there was, in fact, a deep understanding of the interdependence of that ecosystem from probably, if not mystical experience, then very likely a lot of direct observation, which is what you do if you're not in a city all the time. And that kind of direct observation of nature helps us understand our own nature and the importance of respecting all the other members of it.
Yeah, yeah. And how do we help more people feel that? And, I mean, look what we're talking about in terms of climate change. And the struggle is, how many people are trying to deny the fact that there is climate change at all? Because it's such a big, scary thing.
An ever-decreasing number.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we've passed this critical turning point of climate science denial. I mean, there's still a lot of people doing that. But how is it in this modern age that people will have these feelings? And you can raise your kids to be compassionate and socially justice-minded without ever having them do a psychedelic. But it just seems that for a lot of people, myself included, the psychedelics were the doorway to a deeper experience of wholeness, love, connection that motivated me in terms of my actions in the world.
Let's talk for a moment about because you've been alluding to this quite a bit, the psychotherapeutic use of these kinds of drugs and the research that's going on now. It seems that, I mean, Lord knows we live in a society full of deeply traumatized people. Alcoholics, returning veterans, people who have been abused as children. What is being done? What kind of use of these drugs, which have been taboo for so many decades, is going on? Tell us about it.
Well, the strategic decision that I had to make about how to move forward to legitimize psychedelics into our culture was to try to look at which psychedelic and which clinical indication was the pair and most likely to make it through the system. And I'll go back one step further to say that given the enormous amount of propaganda, anti-drug propaganda, and the mass incarceration and the drug war, it seemed like the way into the culture, the path of least resistance, was through medicine and therapy. There is a lot that's being done, particularly here in Santa Fe, with religious freedom for the Uñao de Vegetal, with Santo Daime, the churches that use ayahuasca, the Native American church use peyote. But all of those are crucially important but very limited contexts. The federal government even tried to make it so that the Native American church, you had to be 25% Indian blood even to participate. So they tried to have a racial criteria to be part of a religion. And similarly, you know, UDV and Santo Daime are encased, their religions encased in certain kind of cultural systems that not everybody is going to feel comfortable with. And so it felt like medicine was the way, and science and therapy. So then it seemed like of all the psychedelics, there's the classic psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, ayahuasca, that those psychedelics are challenging in a lot of ways, more ego-dissolving and profound mystical experiences, but also very challenging. And MDMA, on the other hand, is not as mystical, but is more gentle. So it felt to me like MDMA had a real good chance. I was inspired by the work of George Greer and Requa doing the early work with, you know, patients with MDMA when it was still legal. And so the other part of sort of integrating psychedelics into our culture is that we need to train a lot of psychiatrists and psychotherapists. And I think in general, people will be more open to starting with MDMA than with the classic psychedelics.
Now, MDMA is what's known in colloquial English as ecstasy.
Yeah, ecstasy or Molly, methylene dioxy, methamphetamine.
And so what kind of results are you seeing?
Well, the first thing then was MDMA, and then the next was to think what is the most culturally important or potentially high leverage area. And that felt to me like post-traumatic stress disorder, particularly now that it was when I first started looking at this, we had loads of people from Vietnam and that had PTSD. You know, I didn't learn about MDMA till 1982. And now it's Iraq and Afghanistan. And so people have compassion for people with post-traumatic stress disorder. So the results that we're seeing are coming from a combination of MDMA combined with a certain form of psychotherapy. And we've been working since 2000 was the first time that we were able to actually work in a patient population with PTSD. And so we're now at the end of a 15-year stage of research with about 105 patients with PTSD. And we're taking people that have had chronic treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. So the hardest cases, people that are sort of stuck, have failed on currently available medications. And what we're showing is that in a process that involves three MDMA sessions, about 3 to 5 weeks apart, with weekly non-drug psychotherapy. So it's about roughly a 3.5-month process of psychotherapy, about 40 hours of psychotherapy with a male-female co-therapist team, we're finding that people who have been stuck sometimes for decades with post-traumatic stress disorder can overcome it, that they can rewire their brains and rewire their emotions and move forward, wizened, you could say, by their trauma. It's not like it's wiped away, but they can incorporate it into their life and move forward. So we're finding tremendous results with MDMA for post-traumatic stress disorder. And we also have studies with MDMA for people with life-threatening illnesses who are anxious about dying, autistic adults with social anxiety. And we're about to start a study with a therapist affiliated with Veterans Administration, and it's couples therapy where one member of the couple has PTSD. And we have permission from the FDA to give both members of the couple MDMA. And so couples therapy is one of the best uses of MDMA. It helps people to be better listeners. It helps them be less defensive. It helps them be more compassionate. But it's not a disease. So we can never make MDMA into a medicine through the FDA for couples therapy. But by doing couples therapy where it's really focused on PTSD, we're sort of backdoor into looking at couples therapy as well.
So, I mean, what you're finding is that, I mean, people, I know people who have been on antidepressants for years and who have done all kinds of therapy, you know, tapping their heads and tapping their knees and doing all kinds of meditation and all of that stuff. And it works or doesn't work or works a little bit or whatever, but the trauma is still there. What does it look like in people when you say it actually, they get beyond their PTSD, they no longer qualify for the label, I guess, of PTSD. What is a person like in that post-PTSD session, having really lived their lives out of that?
What they're like is more like they were before they were traumatized, you know, and they're more like the rest of us who are not suffering from PTSD. They're able to see events for what they are, rather than bringing this sense that everybody's about to hurt them, that the world is untrustworthy, that they have to constantly be on defensiveness. The thing about PTSD is that you have these memories of these past trauma that intrude on the present and make it difficult for people to see through their filter of pain and trauma into what's actually happening. And so the memories are also not really put into long-term memory, and a lot of them are suppressed and are unconscious. So what we find under the influence of MDMA is that people with PTSD have a reduction. Actually, George Enrico said it best, which was it reduces the fear response to a perceived emotional threat. That was before we even knew that it reduced activity in the amygdala portion of the brain where fear is processed, and it enhances activity in the frontal cortex, where we put things in context.
So that's what I was going to ask you. You're studying the brain analogs of what's going on therapeutically.
Well, we're actually doing some sub-studies, where people get scanned before and after MDMA therapy, and we're now going to be moving into some studies where PTSD patients are going to get scanned while they're under the influence of MDMA. But generally, MAPS is a nonprofit pharmaceutical company, is the best way to understand what we're doing, trying to make psychedelics into prescription medicines. And FDA requires you to prove safety and efficacy, but you don't have to prove mechanism of action, how it works.
Right.
If we had unlimited resources, we would be doing everything, but we're focusing. So I feel our job is to show that it works, and then other people are going to come in and try to figure out how it works.
What the mechanism is.
Yeah. So what we're saying, though, is that under the influence of MDMA, people's trauma can be integrated, that the fear about the emotion is reduced, their memory for the trauma is enhanced, and they're able to move from short-term memory to long-term memory, in the sense that it's out of this reactive, fear-based memory that's constantly intruding. And under the influence of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy or other non-drug psychotherapies that work sometimes too, people are able to say, that happened to me, but it happened in the past, and it's not happening now. And now I have a choice to how I'm going to live. And the whole world isn't like the abuser or the time that I was in Iraq or Vietnam.
Observing these patients, do you notice a change in their body language?
Well, I actually don't have the good fortune of spending much time with patients because I'm more organizing and fundraising and doing regulatory stuff. But I do know some of the patients, and I've been, patient myself. And yeah, their whole body language, their posture can change, their way that they. We see actually with the autistic adults with social anxiety, they can look people in the eyes, whereas before they were too timid to do that, too anxious to do that. That people can reinvest in their own lives and start to have more joy and participation. And there's actually one of the measures that we use is called the post-traumatic growth inventory. And the idea there is that once you've been traumatized, sometimes you can learn to appreciate common, simple kindness that becomes even more important. Or you question, what am I doing with my life? So people reevaluate the meaning and purpose of their life, and you can grow a healthy response to trauma is to sort of be aware of the reality of cruelty and human misery, and then want to do something about it, and then also be more aware and appreciative of simple kindness and love. And so people are able to do more in their lives afterwards than before.
You have a doctorate in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and you've been involved in these issues, as we started talking about, since you were 18 years old. What are your hopes for drug policy in the United States?
I'm hopes that my main hope is that we move to a place where drugs are seen as opportunities, both for healing, for spiritual connection, and also have risks, and that we abandon criminalization completely. We move to a public health approach, and then we try to not just do harm reduction, but do benefit enhancement. So I think that we could actually look as models to the Native American Church, the Uñah de Vegetal, the Santo Daime, the cultures, the Huichols in Mexico. There are cultures that have successfully integrated drugs, and I think that that's where I see we're moving. And the big model for me is the hospice center. So we in the 60s there was really a lot of things that people were reacting against and denying. So death was not something, cancer was not something you talked about. Death was, women were tranquilized to give birth. Yoga and meditation were weird foreign imports. And it was 1974 that the first hospice center took place, was created. And then 30 years later, there was 3,500 of them all over America. So I'm looking forward to psychedelic clinics that will be all throughout the world, thousands and tens of thousands of them, and we'll try to get hundreds of millions of people, to choose to have these experiences that will deepen their appreciations and produce more compassionate, altruistic people.
Rick Doblin, you're laughing.
Well, I mean, that is the vision, is to really fully integrate psychedelics into our culture. And I'm laughing because it used to seem utterly ridiculous to say stuff like that, but I think it's becoming more realistic that we could actually have a world like that.
Rick Doblin is founder and executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. They're on the web at maps.org. Thank you so much for being with
Yeah,
us.
it's been a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.